I'm not sure if that's the precise manufacturing methodology
that's used for the
Pixel.
Literally how they do it, right? Ask yourself, do you know how they build phones? No, you don't, right? Honestly, you get a job at Foxconn and they ask you, have you got your own rolling pin?
Welcome to Bad Voltage, episode 37, here on Thursday, the 23rd of August, 2018, the year of our Lord, 2018. What are we going to be talking about on this show, Mr. Langridge?
Well, one of the things we want to talk about is Slack. Loads of people are using it, but should they be using it? There have been some high-profile defections from Slack, and there's a whole big question about what sort of community is it actually good for, and are we using it more than we should be, or for different reasons than we should be? So we're going to dig into it a bit.
And as has become tradition here on Bad Voltage, we are then going to get into a quite lengthy news sections that covers a pretty wide variety of topics this episode.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Nice addition.
Is there anything else to say on that?
Fine, smooth segue. And now, Bad Voltage.
Hopefully. You know what it's time for?
I do know what it's time for. Is it time for the news, perchance?
How did you guess?
You fool.
It's always a great question. Who wants to start off then? Do you want to give us some sugar, Mr. Langridge?
Well, one of the things we talked in the last show, or possibly the show before, about Hina van Rossum leaving Python, stopping being the BDFL. And they had the Pi Bay conference out in San Francisco, I believe.
Sounds delicious.
It was. They did that conference, and the conclusion from that seems to be, no kind of official notice or anything, but the vibe from that seems to be that things are probably fine, at least for now. I mean, Raymond Hettinger, who's been in Python community for years, said, he'd have presented us with a challenge for self-government, and at this point we don't have any active challenges or something controversial to resolve. And Simeon Franklin said that Python's run by 30 or 40 people these days. It will be interesting to see what happens when a point comes where before someone would have just gone, this is the case, we've made a decision. But Van Rossum's been very loath to do that in the past anyway, to just declare this is right by right of him being BDFL. So you may find it just carries on and nothing really happens. And over the next couple of years, it sort of evolves.
So it sounds like they're basically saying, Guido has said, you know, we have a challenge for self-government, and it's basically all right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's just keep on doing what we're doing.
Yes.
I see the spirit of what they're saying.
I am curious on the long-term
sustainability of said model.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the question. It will be interesting to see what happens the first time something important comes up, and you do get the impression it would behoove them to have solved this problem before that divisive issue arises, rather than resolving it at the same time as the divisive issue.
Right.
But nice use of the word behoove, by the way. That is an understated understated word in the English language.
It will be interesting to see how that gets solved when that happens. But as they say, there are a whole bunch of people doing it, and they're not really a community where it's not like the Linux kernel, where Linus all the time goes, we're doing it this way, we're not doing it that way, and that's the way it's happening.
I think Guido has kept back some features that at least a loud minority of the Python community did want. So
yes.
It's going to be interesting to see how they handle those now, I think.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether everyone starts bringing up all the stuff that Van Rossum shit-canned, just to see if they can get it through now he's gone.
Yes.
that sort of thing seems to be against the spirit of the thing.
And you know what? When you live in a society that that doesn't currently have crime, you don't need a police department.
Well.
And then when someone starts throwing rocks at people's windows, it turns out that you then need to coordinate and have a police department. I'm not suggesting they need a police department, but I do think they need to solve this problem. They need to have at least some accountable leadership in Python. Otherwise, there is going to be further problems down the line. I hope there isn't, but there is going to be.
Well, the standard argument against this is Valve and WL Gore, right?
Is what?
Companies that run without a hierarchy. So
they're fine to a certain size, and then they have to bring hierarchy in.
But how big's the Python community? The core dev community I'm talking about now. I mean, I'm part of the Python community that says that I write things in Python, but I'm not involved in that kind of discussion. How big is that? Is it as big as Valve is? Probably not. Is it as big as WL Gore? Probably not. And they work without managers, without there being one person at the top. There's no one with a desk which says the buck stops here on it.
You're drawing a correlation between the size of the organization and
Drawing the correlation between
saying is that in organizations that can get away without having a hierarchy, that usually breaks down at a point when they reach a certain size.
Yeah.
Right? So there's very few organizations that are very large that don't have a hierarchy.
Yes.
Now that's not to say that that all small organizations can operate without a hierarchy. There are many organizations that have been very small, some of which, it should be noted, I have worked for, that don't function well without a hierarchy. So you could have a small company of 20 people, or a small community of 20 people that need that clear leadership in place. That's all I'm saying.
Again, the argument from people who support hierarchy-less places, which are few and far between, is that everyone going, no, we need a hierarchy, really, is you're doing it wrong. Now, I'm not necessarily sure I buy this argument, to be clear. Well,
and let's also be clear about the places that don't have hierarchies. They have hierarchies. They're just not formal as well. Every place that claims it doesn't have a hierarchy has a hierarchy.
Because even Zappos, who was very big on that we don't have a hierarchy, had a little bit of a hierarchy.
Well, this is the question, and this is management theory stuff, but this is what everybody thinks. They're like, nah, it's there, really. You just don't write it on the business cards. They're like, you know what? And people have done studies on this and so on and so forth. I don't know whether they're honestly most, I don't want to say mostly unique, because things are either unique or it isn't, but there were like half a dozen companies who've done this. It's really rare, but I wonder whether community is the sort of place where you can do this, because a lot of the time the hierarchy comes in because it's whoever's got the money or whatever, right? But that doesn't necessarily apply in something like this.
The thing that's risky about this in my mind is I think the gist of what you're saying, Ak, is that, you know, if those 30 or 40 people are highly collaborative, they get on well, they work well with each other, then you basically don't have a problem. And I agree, like, if it isn't broken, you don't necessarily need to fix it. But, you know, it might not be broken right now, but things will change in the future. And they, I think in communities, you'll have certain well-respected people. Like, a good example of this, I think, is KDE. KDE historically has been a leaderless community. One of the few leaderless communities in open source that I'm aware of. But there are certain people in the KDE community that are just really well respected, who people will get behind. A good example of that is Aaron Saigo, right? So Aaron Saigo retooled and refocused a lot of what KDE were doing. And he wasn't a leader. He wasn't in any formal position, but people got behind him because they supported him. And we do see a lot of that happening. And that, I think, is good when you generally have a community that's pretty mature and doesn't have that many issues. Like, KDE hasn't really had that many problems over the years. And maybe that's the situation with Python, but given the fact that Guido is leaving because of a stated toxicity around how decisions are being made, I would argue that they do need to have someone else. They need to have some kind of thing.
That kind of is the thing. I'm not eager to see them necessarily reach for the way we solve this is by giving one person a bigger hammer.
Well, not one person.
Giving five people really big hammers is the same thing.
No, no, it isn't at all. Having a delegated governance board of five people or seven people is not the same as one person being in charge at all.
But that's exactly the sort of thing we're talking about. Let's say Franklin says Python's run by 30 or 40 people these days, and of those 30 or 40, there are, you know, half a dozen, maybe 10, who have more respect than everybody else. This is the kind of thing you were talking about with KDE back in the day. I don't know what the KDE community is like now for that.
Yeah, no idea.
But in general, in almost every open source community that doesn't have a clear delineated leader, there'll be the half dozen people at the top who everyone respects and listens to and who guide things through longer. I mean, imagine, right, if Linus chucked it all in tomorrow, there probably wouldn't be a new Linus. I know people have started talking about this sort of thing.
I think there would be.
I don't think there'd be a top tier of multiple.
I think there would be half a dozen people, and you could name them all now, you know. Right. And I think that would be the case. I don't think there would necessarily be one person who just makes the decisions.
You know, we're really good at predictions, right? So when Linus decides to step down or, you know, is the victim of some oversized penguin-related incident at a zoo, Greg KH is going to be the new Linux.
I don't think so.
I think the Linux community is going to operate on the model that it's always operated
You think they're going to go, well, we need someone to run this, and now you're the guy, even if Greg doesn't necessarily want to.
Yeah. I mean, many caveats to this. I don't particularly know the Linux.
Some people aspire to leadership. Some people have leadership thrust upon them. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know Greg massively well, but he will be a logical person in my mind. I just don't think they'd have a radically different leadership model in Linux if Linus stepped down. When Linus steps down.
Well, there is the kind of advantage that there isn't one Linux. You know, the thing that people call Linux is just Linus's tree. And if everyone just starts using Greg's tree instead, they could do that today if they wanted to. But there aren't a million different Pythons.
I mean, and yeah.
Or a million different KDEs, or a million different almost anything.
KDE itself is a million different KDEs and clocks.
That is unkind. I am told these days it's actually really cool, and I keep meaning to try it. I don't know how much this is. I don't know how much this is failing whitely propaganda.
I don't know. I think the KDE project do lots of good stuff. As do the Elementary project. As do the GNOME project. Many of them. So, should we move on?
Yes, move on.
I have a bit of news. Apparently, Facebook are going to be reviewing people on their quote trustworthiness. So I don't know if this has been the same in Buffalo, birthplace of the wing, and Birmingham, birthplace of the, stabbing.
Well, I would have said Black Sabbath, but it's up to you. What's it like in the Bay Area, birthplace for spending £5,000 a week on a flat, Jono?
Well, yeah, there is that. But you know why that is? Because people want to live here. The Facebook have been advertising bloody everywhere about how they're cracking down on fake news and this. I don't know if it's been the same.
Fake news is not our friend, and so on and so forth. Yep,
that's all that stuff.
That's all over everywhere. That's all over here. I'm assuming it's all over Buffalo. Did you see that someone has been changing the adverts in London? So going and pasting big bit of paper over the bottom half of the advert. So it says, fake news is not our friend. They pasted a bit on the bottom. It says, it's our business model. And somehow it's brilliant. Super duper impressed with it.
I'm so proud to be British.
I know. And, you know, it's in the right font and everything. So it just looks completely correct. It's just excellent.
Lol. Well, I'm going to quote from an article. Facebook hasn't been shy about rating the trustworthiness of news outlets, but it's now applying what that thinking to users as well. The company's Tessa Lyons has revealed to the Washington Post that it's starting to assign users' reputation scores on a 0 to 1 scale. The system is meant to help Facebook's fight against fake news by flagging people who routinely make false claims against news outlets, whether it's due to an ideological disagreement or a personal grudge. This isn't the only way Facebook gauges credibility, according to Lyons. It's just one of thousands of behavior markers Facebook is using. The problem is much of how this works is a mystery, and Facebook won't say how it calculates those scores or who gets those scores and how other factors contribute to a person's trustworthiness. This is an interesting idea, but I mean, what do you guys think about it? In a perfect world, this would make sense, yes. But this isn't a perfect world.
It seems rife with unintended consequences to me. And given Facebook's history, dubious that they could get it correct.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. It's the secrecy is half it. Like, if you went to them and said, okay, so let's look at organizations and what's their trustworthiness rating. What's Facebook's trustworthiness rating? Surprise me.
Zero.
Is it 1.0? Right. Which is exactly the problem. You know, how are you rating people who revealed stuff about Facebook you didn't want talked about? This is the problem with having scores that are hidden from people, operated by a group of people who consider themselves the best arbiters of this stuff. Well, the other thing, right, I don't quite understand is, I would have thought that the trustworthiness score of a person is related to the trustworthiness scores of the stuff they share, right? But what they actually call out in the article is they say, and I'm just quoting the thing you just said here. Where is it? It's meant to help Facebook's fight against fake news by flagging people who routinely make false claims against news outlets. Now, are people doing that? I mean, I'm seeing people sharing a thing which makes a false claim about a news outlet, but not themselves doing it. I don't think people are saying the Washington Post is lying in a tweet themselves. They might be sharing a thing from the Daily Caller saying the Washington Post is lying, or from Donald Trump saying,
"If you so you can report news as fake now, right?"
Yeah.
They're saying if you continually report news items as fake that they deem to not be fake,
oh,
it will be a ding on your trustworthiness.
So, but this
in the same way that if you posted fake news continually, right, it would also be a ding on your,
right,
trustworthiness.
Right, but this is not actually about assessing you on the basis of what you share. This is stopping people abusing the reporting system.
Correct. That one, okay, signal.
But yeah, okay, but that seems like just Facebook internal fiddling. That's not actually fixing the problem. I mean, yeah, fine, it is a problem that people are reporting things, yes, in order to game the system, but that's a second order issue, right?
Yes.
Well, it's tricky as well because, I mean, you know, if I just today, just reading the news, like, you know, I, as I'm sure you guys do, I try to source my news from a multitude of different sources and make my own decision. I don't just read one source. And just today on Google News, by the way, we talked about Google News in a show a while back when we covered Google I.O.
Yep.
And I don't know if you've been using it, but I think Google News is actually really good. You know, reading something on Fox, I read something on Fox and something on CNN, and both were massively speculative, not particularly grounded in a lot of fact, heavily opinion-based. And I think it would be quite reasonable to suggest that those two news stories weren't actually particularly good news on both sides. And so if I was to report those, would I be dinged for that? Because I would say that that's factually correct. I'm not suggesting that, you know, it's not like saying, oh, this Breitbart story is guaranteed truth, or InfoWars. I mean, InfoWars is a whole separate thing, but sometimes reporting incorrect news, you're right about it, but then somebody else might not necessarily agree with that's incorrect news.
Well, you,
right,
see, the acid test...
It's massively subjective. Yeah.
The acid test for this is very much if you say to Facebook, okay, so what you're looking to do is find people who point at real news organisations who are reporting the truth and call them fake news, and then you reduce their trustworthiness rating, do you? And that applies to everybody? Because I can name one guy who does that quite a lot, and it would be interesting to see what his trustworthiness rating is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I'm mainly concerned about the secret. Facebook see themselves as being above this problem. That they're not part of it. They are arbiters of whether it's occurring or not.
Yeah. I think this is one of those things where they know. I mean, they've got absolutely hammered about fake news. And when you have your founder up in front of, you know, in front of the government awkwardly drinking water and, you know, talking about this stuff. Like, you've got to do something about it. And I think they're grasping at straws. I think the spirit behind this is great, but it's the devil's in the detail, right? So,
yeah.
Jeremy, what have you got for us?
So one follow-up, which I think is actually a follow-up to a follow-up. Did you see that the couple members of Congress are now kind of grilling Ajit Pai on his...
the DDoS thing.
So it says, today, four Democrats on the House of Energy and Commerce Committee sent a letter to Pai, quote unquote, demanding to know when he and his staff learned that the commission had provided inaccurate information about why its comment system went down during the net neutrality repeal public comment period, end quote. So this is kind of interesting to me that A, I think it's clear that he did not do the right thing, but B, it seems to me there's a trend now of politicians dragging people, like they did with Zuckerberg, which we just kind of mentioned, dragging people in front of Congress, yelling at them, and then saying they did something, but then they don't actually do something. So it'll be interesting to see if anything comes of this. I think the FCC has now acknowledged, at least according to this Ars article, that it was John Oliver asking viewers of his program last week tonight to oppose Pai's net neutrality repeal that caused the DDoS. Which I'm sure John Oliver quite happy about that.
Well, this is the thing I don't get is if you say, okay, we want votes from the public, and then you get loads. Yes, technically that's a distributed denial of service, but you don't get to complain about it.
The whole thing is ludicrous.
I do kind of get the impression, you know, Bruce Schneier talks about security theatre, where you do stuff that doesn't actually fix the problem, but looks like you're trying to fix the problem. A lot of this sort of thing feels rather politics theatre, where instead of fixing the problem, you make someone stand in front of a special investigation in front of Congress. But doesn't actually, everyone gets their day in the sun and to be on... and to be on TV asking hard questions, but I don't know how much it actually fixes.
It's funny you say that. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, you know, there was, without turning this into a political discussion, there was this guy called Peter Strzok, who worked for the FBI and was basically, they found some text messages on his phone where he basically said, you know, oh, we'll get rid of Trump and, you know, some anti-Trump stuff. And he was involved in the Mueller investigation that was taken off. So Mueller was made aware of these texts and immediately removed him from the investigation. And he was called up in front of the, I think it was the House Intelligence Committee, to basically, you know, answer some questions about these texts. And the undercurrent of this discussion was, you know, he's biased. He's involved in the Mueller campaign, trying to undermine the Mueller campaign, the Mueller investigation. And I watched. I went through a week or so of just watching these interrogations from various people. Like I saw one with Mueller on it. I saw one with Rosenstein in it, and a few others. And these sessions are nothing about actually trying to find any truth. It seems more about basically punishing the person who's in front of them. A lot of it was, you know, each person has 5 minutes, whatever, and they'll spend 4 of the 5 minutes basically slamming the person that's in front of them for whatever reason, and then one question or something like that, and they won't allow the person to respond. It was absolutely ridiculous
because they're strutting to demonstrate how much they love America rather than try to fix the damn problem.
Right,
and it's made for TV.
It's politics theatre. It's ridiculous.
God, it drives me nuts. Yeah.
So in similar government news, did you see the thing about the Phoebes asking for everyone's address? there was a robbery.
No.
In Maine, I think it was. And the FBI went to Google and said, okay, this robbery happened at this time in this place. We want from you everyone who, according to your systems, was in the area of that. And we want their names, we want their addresses and their account activity, please. Google went, get to fuck. No way are we giving you that. And unfortunately, they did not. But this is kind of a concerning new approach, right? From my point of view, at least, it's good that Google said no, But first of all, you don't know how many times they've said yes and we don't find out about it. And secondly, you don't know how many times, you know, if the laws start changing in the future so they can't say no or whatever. It's, you're not supposed to be able to ask for that kind of thing.
But hang on, let me understand this correctly. So there was a robbery and they basically asked for the names and addresses of everybody in that area.
Yes.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yep. Yep.
Putting aside the rights and the wrongs of whether Google should do that, I wonder why they took that approach. Because that would be a lot of data.
Well, they didn't happen to fill that in the request form. I can imagine someone sitting there in a suit going, you know what, it would be really, really easy if we could just find the names of everyone who was near here at the time. Goodness. And I agree with you. That would certainly make your job easier.
It would make things easier, for sure.
I mean, one of the more amusing things about this is because it's on Forbes, right? You go there, follow the link, and then it says, it pops up the, now you have to click here to agree to a bunch of stuff. Now, this may only apply because I'm in the EU, right? But it pops up the, we'll show you this once you click to agree. And then it says, some opt-outs may fail due to your browser's cookie settings. If you'd like to set opt-out preferences using this tool, you have to allow third-party cookies in your browser settings. I'm like, no, I don't have to allow third-party cookies, and then it doesn't matter what my opt-out preferences are because I'm opting out, regardless of your opinion.
I tell you what, I was in the UK last week, and the internet's become annoying in England. Every freaking website that you go to, you have to make a decision about this.
Yep.
Oh, it's infuriating.
It is infuriating. But that's because this is much like, you know, the EU cookie law, which was completely ridiculous because everyone popped up things saying, hey, we're going to use cookies now.
And it so sounds you like have a really fun law, but it isn't.
It sounds does. Delicious.
It does. Sounds like a delightful law, not actually delightful. and so everyone ended up with banners all over the website saying, we use cookies and click here if you don't like that or whatever. The point of the law was to say, you just can't do this. GDPR was the same thing, right? Instead of everyone popping up a box which said, okay, we're going to set all these cookies unless you opt out of them. And then you click opt out and it shows you a list of 400 different things and you have to untick all of them. Right? What they're supposed to do is just not do it. That's what the law says. You just can't do this. But obviously, ad companies don't want to be put entirely out of the tracking business despite the fact that that's what the law was meant to do. And so I wonder whether there's going to be some kind of big test case or something. It certainly is very annoying. But I don't know what else can happen. This is one of those things where if my six numbers come up on the lottery tomorrow evening or something, I might dedicate the rest of my life to reporting all of these companies to the Information Commissioner.
You know what, dude? Everyone needs a dream.
There it is. It's right there, right? After I built the champagne fountain in the living room, I'm doing that next.
So actually, I, not to switch the topic from the lovely champagne fountain, but I actually have a... Did you see the number of third-party cookies on EU news sites dropped by 22% post-GDPR?
I did. It's working.
So it's interesting. So the UK was by far the largest drop at 45%.
Yeah.
The Germany was by far the smallest at 6%. Interestingly, in Poland, there's a 20% uptick, which they were the vast, vast outlier on that one. But I didn't
understand that. I don't know if they went, this thing that's been banned, we were allowed to do that before? Just do it. No one's going to ask.
Maybe, but if you dig into the details, I think some of the details are actually a little interesting. One of them was new sites stopped deploying tracking cookies related to web design and optimization tools by far the most, so almost by a third. Marketing tools and advertising tools only saw a 14% drop, which I would have thought was higher. Social media saw a 9% reduction. And the number of sites using adjacent cookie tracking for buttons like Facebook and Twitter went from 84%, which is astonishingly high, to 77%, which is still higher.
Astonishingly high, but fractionally less astonishing.
Because of the browser plugins I use, I don't see those. I didn't realize they were that pervasive.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we discussed the GDPR in detail some shows ago, but I think... The trend is directionally correct. It's not had the original effect that it was hoped it would, but it's certainly a move in the right direction. We could still argue about whether the misery is worth it.
Yeah.
But just kind
it's trying to solve a problem that needs solving, yeah. Right? So once again, we I know we always say this, there is a spirit of something and then there is the, you know, the reality of it.
Yeah.
But I think we're all in favor of the spirit of it. It's just the reality is where it gets a little tricky.
Yes. Right. New news.
I have one that's not particularly exciting in itself, but I think is an interesting discussion. Is I saw this article on The Verge, which is basically talking about how $1,000 phones have become normal. The Galaxy Note 9, the iPhone X, the Note 8, the Oppo Fix X, Oppo Find, actually, I think that it should be, and then probably the Pixel 3, at least one of the higher end models of the Pixel 3. $1,000 phones are becoming pretty normal, and the gist of the article was saying, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, the idea of spending $1,000 on a phone, most people would say, is ridiculous, and it's become pretty normal now.
Now,
is that fine?
So, a couple of things. First of all, no, it isn't fine. Secondly, yes, it is still ridiculous. But thirdly, I think I'd at least partially dispute their assumption that it's normal. I suspect it's normal if you're a Verge journalist. Right, and if you hang out with the sort of people who Verge journalists hang out with. But I tried to put together some sales figures for 2018 for different phone models. Now, this is hard to do because it's not very well. It's not very well reported. When it is reported, it's not very accurate. When it is accurate, it's not very well broken down. So this is very, very, very rough and speculative. But as far as I can tell, for Apple phones in 2018, roughly, very roughly, half of the phones they're selling are the iPhone X, which is your $1,000 phone, right? But for Samsung, and we unilaterally declare here that Apple and Samsung sell all the phones and all other Android manufacturers are a rounding error, which is terribly unfair to them, but I don't care, right? As far as I can tell, the Samsung high-end flagship model is only about 10% of their sales. So
that doesn't surprise me.
$1,000 or in the US and the UK,
my numbers are kind of US-ish.
In Birmingham.
I tell you this, there are more iPhone X's than I expected to see in Birmingham, but they're certainly not half the full phones on the damn street. I can tell you that. But yeah, so
it's a lot of flip phones.
It's not massively clear whether these figures are US or whether they're the Western world or what, right? So take this with a mountain composed entirely of salt. But nonetheless, right, this is like the Dead Sea of salt taking to go with this thing. But if that's the case, I would say that, yeah, if you're the sort of person who hangs about somewhere where 75-80% of people have got iPhones, as opposed to the 40% it is in the rest of the world. Right, if almost all of your mates have got iPhones, if you're in a very tech-centric place where loads and loads of people have got iPhones, then yeah, half the phones you see will be iPhone X's, and therefore a $1,000 phone is normal. If you're outside that kind of a bubble, I think they're not as normal, but give it another couple of years and yeah, those phones will... I think the price is just creeping up way more than inflation would dictate.
But certainly, I think increasingly as people, especially people who aren't us, don't use a computer and only use their phone, the amount they use their phone is so much higher than it used to be that the absolute value they're getting at it, I would argue, decreases regardless if they're spending more on the phone.
But that's fair. I mean, I've said repeatedly, spending £600 or £700 or £800 on a phone is not in itself inherently a bad thing because I look at the damn thing 12 hours a day, right? I'm justified spending good money. Yeah. In the same way that you're justified spending good money on a decent monitor if you spend as much time looking at your computer as we do. It's a false economy to buy cheap stuff because you just hate it.
I take the same view, which is, you know, my next phone will probably cost near to $1,000, and that's because it's a significant part of my professional and personal life. And I'm happy to invest significantly in something that represents as much of my life as that.
I am honestly debating having mine super glued to my hand. But yeah, I mean, so it's, I mean, it always amazed me that people would say, oh goodness, these phones are very expensive, but then quite happily drop £2,000 on a camera and another £1,000 on a lens to go with it. I'm like, you pick that up once a week. You look at your phone 8 hours a day. Why would you not spend money on it?
Yeah, no,
what,
it's true.
What I don't want to become the situation is that we divide the world into phones that cost $1,000 and stupid, low-end, terrible phones without enough RAM, which are really slow and annoying, and there's no middle ground.
There is a middle ground.
Jeremy holds up his essential to the screen. Assuming they don't go bust in the next 5 minutes. They're doing, yeah, doing okay at the moment, right?
Not really, but but with the latest price drop, it is probably dollar for dollar the best phone you can. I will say it's the best phone you could buy.
How much are they now? I've not seen this.
I think you can get it on sale now for like $300.
An essential phone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is the thing.
If you are looking for a phone, it is very near to a current flagship. I still get about 2 days of battery life, even after a full year, which is really not bad. It got Pi before the Pixel did. I mean, it's a nice phone.
Yeah.
I have a...
Bad Voltage is brought to you by Essential. Actually, do you think they'd actually score us some phones? That'd be cool. Send them an email or something.
To be clear, go on, I purchased mine at full price.
Yeah.
And that's great for you.
no special bleeding in. Anyway, you're a fine one to talk, Jono. Google have given you like 12 pixels and you keep throwing them in the toilet or something.
I have bought all of my pixels, which is one. but I have not had great success in having the Pixel remain on and used.
Oh, it's terrible.
Due to various drinking games and toilets.
Are you going to get the Pixel 3?
Which are not connected, by the way.
Pixel 3 is due out in, October, November, whenever it is, right?
The expectation is October the 5th.
Are you getting it?
Yes.
Thought so.
Yes. I am almost certainly going to buy the high-end model. So, I love my Pixel. I thought it was great. And I'm annoyed again that Jeremy was right and in lambasting me for not buying a phone that was waterproof. And I was like, oh, it doesn't need to be waterproof.
I am holding out hope that they release a Pixel that is not a tablet-sized device. Because conceptually, I really like it. I think the clean interface is awesome. I like a lot of what they're doing around the design.
Yeah.
I just absolutely unequivocally do not want a phone that big. And I've said this now enough shows that it's probably irritating for listeners, but I still think people want a good screen and great battery life and a decent radio in the phone so you can actually get text and make calls and do things that actually have a data signal where other phones don't. Just those features would sell a phone.
Yeah.
What's irritating is that, according to rumors, so the Pixel 3 XL will have the notch and everything. So you'll have there is a bezel on the bottom where the speakers are on the front of the phone, which I personally think is a good thing. But the non-XL version of the Pixel won't have the notch. It'll just be a normal size phone with a big rim around the edge of it, which seems a little odd to me, because I would have thought the smaller the screen, the more screen space you need.
You would think. I mean, if they brought out what annoyingly they'd probably call a Pixel Mini, I shall spare you my standard rant about phone sizes, but if they brought out one that was...
You
are familiar with it, but if they brought out one that was the sort of size that I wanted, they'd probably call it a Pixel Mini, and I'd love to buy that. That would be very cool, Google.
Yeah, but you basically just want a Nokia 3210 size phone.
I do
phone,
not want
you?
A Nokia 3210. Shut up. What? To be honest with you, I think my phone would have the same volume as a Pixel XL. It's just you get a proper size phone and then roll it out with a rolling pin till it's really thin and really large, and then sell it as a Pixel XL. Anyway,
I'm not sure if that's the precise manufacturing methodology
literally how they do it, right? Ask yourself, do you know how they build phones? No, you don't, right? Honestly, you get a job at Foxconn and they ask you, have you got your own rolling pin? That's how it works.
We'll have to coordinate an interview with someone from Foxconn, apart from the fact that those people aren't allowed out of the factory.
Well, I suspect they do not ask if you've got your own rolling pin. Yes.
That would be a great question. Tell us about the rolling pin. All right. I think we might be done with news.
I think that is indeed enough news. Thank you very much. There's a blogging platform, a content platform, they'd call it, called Ghost.
Yep.
And the chap who runs it, John O'Nolan.
Great name.
No.
Excellent name.
John O'Nolan. Two separate things. Not John O. Yeah, because let's be clear about this. John O is not a name.
You have a modicum of a point. You're just saying it slowly, though. It's John O.
John O'Nolan. For Ghost, he tweeted a few days ago. He tweeted a little while ago, actually, some months ago. After 4 years of running an 11,000 member public Slack community for Ghost, today we've decided to shut the whole thing down for good. To be clear, shut their Slack channel down, not Ghost. And he then runs a he then has a long thread and people get into discussions and so on and so forth. But I'm increasingly seeing people start to feel the limitations of Slack at collecting together communities, especially larger communities. People starting to run into the free limits and so on and so forth. So my question here is, do you think the bloom's gone off the rose a bit? What do you think is causing this? And how do you think things are going to change?
I think Slack is a medium that is marketed as one thing when it's actually something quite different. So the reputation and the marketing spiel that you see around Slack is that, you know, you basically spin up Slack and you build a community in it. Whereas I personally tend to think of it more as an instant messaging platform. It's a place, you know, for businesses, for example, if you have a small business, you know, a couple of hundred people, it's very common, certainly in tech, that people will have Slack as one of the main areas in which they communicate. And it's fantastic for that. Like, if you need to let someone know that you're going to be a few minutes late for a meeting, if you need to ask someone a quick question, but one-on-one or one to a limited number of people discussions, I think Slack is a really great platform, as is Mattermost and, you know, Discord and similar kind of variants. But it's not a community. It's not really the best platform, I would argue, for building a scalable community, because you basically get bitten by the Dunbar number, which is, you know, how many people you can reasonably know, and also just how many people you can reasonably communicate with. So
I don't necessarily
lots of people put it in place as that scalable community, as it seems like Ghost did, and then they realize, you know, one of the downsides is the scale element, but there's also various other downsides, such as, you know, getting history and things like that. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me doesn't feel like necessarily a limitation of Slack per se. It's when you get into this discussion, you'll see an awful lot of people pop up and say Slack isn't really designed for an 11,000 person community. It's designed for smallish teams at work. And you say, well, yeah, but Slack don't tell you that. And you do kind of get the impression that when it started to take off and people started using it for bigger and bigger communities, Slack could have said, this is not really what we're for. But on the one hand was saying that, and on the other hand was unlimited growth and money. And so they went, nothing to do with us, use it for everything. But it does seem to fall down. It works really well, I think, when you've got a small team who are remote from one another and it's a good place to communicate. The sort of tech team who would have been using some kind of IM system before this, you know, long time ago, would have been IRC,
chat, like
might have been HipChat, something like that. Slack took things like that and did lots of nice things to make that conversation experience more pleasant. It's when everyone went, well, okay, so we like Slack, so let's use it for everything where we need to chat to people, that it seems to have fallen down, I think.
I kind of think I disagree with both of you in slightly different ways. I think they do very much message it as, don't use it for that use case. It's a bad solution for that. Very much. I mean, if you read all of their marketing and messaging for a very long time now, it's been about collaboration at work for teams, not about any in any way, shape, or form building communities.
They could trivially stop this problem.
Just I think they kind of have dissuaded you greatly by the way their free plan works and the cost, the onerous cost that would be a 10,000 person Slack community. I think they have highly dissuaded you.
Just cap every instance at 150 people and there'd never have been this problem.
So I don't think the Dunbar number applies because it's not a room. If you use channels effectively, you can easily have more than 150 people in the entire chat, in your entire workspace, sorry. Teams are going to coalesce in a work environment around channels.
You know as well as we do, Jeremy, that doesn't happen.
So
channel proliferation.
You do.
Because you know... I get what you're saying, but to me, it doesn't really matter. Like, whether we're talking about it being used for work or whether we're talking about it being used for communities isn't really that big of a deal, I don't think. Because you face the same problem if you have a 10,000-person company that you do as a 10,000-person community. The problem with Slack is because it's a real-time linear chat channel is that... It means that if you're chatting with other people in the moment in a focused discussion, it works very well. But if you need to broaden it beyond that, if you need to have lots of people involved, if you need to be breaking that linearity in some way, or if you need to find prior discussions and agreements and decisions, it's really not well suited for that. So to me, it doesn't really matter whether it's work, whether it's community. And I'm not surprised that Slack don't go out there and say, no, really, we're not for communities. Like, why would they do that? You know? They like their success, I'm sure.
Well, the risk.
I think that's more what I'm disagreeing
with.
Is I think they have said that.
I don't think they have. I've never seen it.
Whereas I think that when you say, "Well, why would they say that?" The risk is if people start going, "Ah, but Slack seems really irritating." They're not going to go, "Slack seems really irritating because we're using it for the wrong use cases." This is what I said: is the bloom going off the rose when it stops being the trendy thing, the seesaw tips, and then they become MySpace. Right? Which they presumably ought to be worried about.
Well, and you know, this is something we've touched on quite a lot in previous shows, is there is the public understanding and perception and usage of something, and then there is the actual messaging that comes from a company. I don't think any of us are saying that Slack has gone out intentionally to say, like, we are a community platform. They're not having the same kind of messaging that Discourse has, for example. They're very much focused
on
work.
Or Discord, for that matter.
Right. You know, and they're very much focused on work. And I would say in the last year or so, I mean, I'm not tracking what Slack are doing on a day-by-day basis, but it seems like they've become particularly focused on the work angle and the work messaging, because I think they've identified this as a problem. I do think that part of the reason why we're seeing this problem that was outlined in the Ghost community is because people are using it in a scenario that isn't the right way for it to be used. I see this all the time with my clients. I always say to them, like, do not use Slack as your primary communications platform for your community. It's not designed for that. And that's surprising to a lot of people because they think of Slack as a community thing.
Yeah, Jeremy, I absolutely take your point that people have been saying this, Slack themselves have been saying this is not really what it's for. But regardless of that, the message that seems to be out there in people's heads is, we want to get a bunch of disparate people together, let's set up a Slack to do it.
Yep.
So what should people be doing?
This is not going to be a surprise to many of you who listen to this from my angle. I think the solution to this is that you use in a simple word, discourse. But it's not really so much specifically discourse. It's that you use a platform that. Well, let me back up. The way I tend to look at this is that I think you've got two types of communication in the world. I call it structured and unstructured, right? So structured is it's where you've got a very, very specific outcome. So, for example, a GitHub issue is there is a problem, and the whole discussion in the issue is about rectifying that problem and resolving it. That's how issues should be used. Obviously, people will post random crap into issues, put that to one side. Another example of this is a Q&A thread on Stack Exchange. Very specific question and very specific answers. So in structured communication, you don't get people saying, hey, how are the kids this weekend? You know, how are you doing? What are you doing this week? Are you going to this conference? You don't get that kind of stuff. Unstructured communication is that kind of general, in my mind, is that general area of discussion, which can be both social, but it can also be, you know, ideas and collaboration around a project or a community or what you're going to do, where you're going to move forward. And within unstructured communication, you can basically break it down into real time, such as Slack, and then non-real time, such as Discourse and forums. And I would argue that non-real time is a more structured way, a more stable way of doing it, because the benefit of that is it makes, for example, finding earlier discussions and material easier. You can enter into a discussion from 3 weeks ago very easily in something like Discourse, whereas you can't do that as easily in Slack. The problem with non-real time, unstructured platforms such as that, in my mind, is in those platforms you don't. It's harder to build those kinds of personal relationships. You can, like, people will often let their personality come through, but it's very normal in Slack or in IRC or in Discord for people to, you know, to talk about what they watched on telly last night, or to talk about a band that they just went and saw. And that's how you build those relationships. So I think you need a blend of these. I always recommend use Slack or Mattermost or something as your instant messaging where people can kind of hang out, but do the work on something such as Discourse. Then I think you get a bit.
I think the lack of essentially instant gratification is important. Yeah, if I want to write something for the ages, then it gets written down and composed beforehand and goes into a text box and so on. But just shooting the shit with people, or just chatting about things, or if I've got a question where I want an answer in the next 15 minutes rather than in the next 15 days, I'll ask it on Slack. In the same way, if I want to know where we're going this, you know, if I want to say to friends where we're going this evening, I'm not going to send them all an email. I'm going to send them a text message, right?
Yeah.
And that's the instant gratification thing. Yeah, I mean, the two things do kind of need to go hand in hand, but then that seems almost too much organisation and too much effort. If you want to spin up something, some kind of community with kind of a purpose, going, well, we've got a forum and we've got Slack, or we've got a forum and we've got Mattermost or something, and they're defining which goes where and so on, that seems to me like it would make things harder to spin up. I don't know. Jeremy, what do you think?
So I guess I'm not clear, and I can't believe I'm the person that, at least the perception is going to be I'm defending Slack, because I'm probably the most Slack fatigued out of the three of us. But
yeah,
that's true.
You tell clients for inter-team and intra-team communication to use Discourse?
No, that's not what I said.
I was confused. So
So this is what I tell clients. If you're building, so break it into two pieces. You've got internal discussion inside of a company, right? I would always recommend you use something such as Slack or Mattermost for that. Set up your channels, have individual team channels, and there needs to be a lot of structure around that, so you don't get channel proliferation and things such as that. But that's something that's great for your internal teams. Now, externally, for your public community, I would recommend focusing more on a platform such as Discourse, which is what your community interact with. But then if you want to provide, in addition to that, a public Slack channel or a Mattermost channel where people can kind of hang out and build relationships and ping people and be a little bit more informal, then that's a nice thing to add on top of that. But gotcha. No, I'd never recommend someone uses Discourse purely internally. I mean, there has been a couple of clients where that's been appropriate, but that's primarily being where real-time chat channels have been blocked. Various reasons.
Gotcha. So I think for building an external community, Slack doesn't make sense, and I think their messaging is clear on that now. Perhaps it wasn't earlier in their growth cycle.
Yeah.
But so what do we think's going to happen? I mean, it does feel to me like people are less jumping on the Slack bandwagon now, but I don't know if that's because the people are actually realizing that it's not for a lot of the stuff they're using it for, or whether they're just not this week's cool thing.
The tricky thing in my mind is I think everybody naturally wants to find a single platform that works well for everything. And I think
I would certainly agree everyone wants to produce a single platform that works right. well for everything.
And the thing is that I don't think that's feasible in many ways.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see this as a tech problem. This is a people problem.
Yes, totally.
It is. We're effectively talking about the categorization of communication into logical pieces.
It doesn't work.
First of all, even if you have those logical pieces, it doesn't necessarily mean that anybody's going to follow them, which is when you see a lot of crap in GitHub issues, as an example. So to me, the where you can integrate these different elements together as effectively as possible, that makes sense. Now, Jeff Atwood, you know, who co-created Discourse and co-created Stack Exchange, I would argue that he's one of the most talented people in the world of solving these kinds of problems from an infrastructure perspective. And they've integrated Discourse and Slack, and it's good, but it's by no means intuitive, I don't think.
I don't feel like it works very well at all. We've got that here in Birmingham for some of the tech scene stuff, and they hang together very inefficiently. It feels very much like one thing is sort of poking its nose into the other, but there are no hard and fast lines to define in between these things. And if even bringing up the discussion of, well, this shouldn't really be here, this should be here instead, makes you look like a prissy rule maker and kills the whole discussion. You know, I mean, we've talked endlessly about how the important thing to do is to enforce the culture that you want for your community in ways that don't involve you standing there with a big stick with a nail in it and going, stick with the culture.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, I think, because I think we are looking for this kind of like single solution to the problem. And I think the only way to do this is to very clearly delineate what these different things are for. Like some of the communities that I've seen that I think do a good job here, make it very clear that if you submit anything that isn't a bug to your issue tracker, it will be removed. And that if you submit a bug to the forum, it will be removed. And you've got to, I think, be that disciplined. Slack, in my mind, wraps around that. It's like it seeps into all the little holes that that your GitHub issues and your Discourse and whatever else doesn't naturally fit into. But the problem with something like Slack as well is that, as we've seen for years in IRC, is that if you've got a problem, people don't go and read manuals. People don't go and post in the place where you're supposed to get help. They log into a channel and they ask questions and hope that someone responds. So I think we've also got to accept that there is basically no good solution to this. You just got to do the best with what you got. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with Ghost. I mean, they've moved to Discourse.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about Discourse is it doesn't just become a place where you can have that unstructured communication, but you can use it for more structured stuff. So, for example, a lot of clients that I've worked with, we have the Solved plugin set up, which effectively provides like a limited level of Stack Exchange type functionality where you can ask a question and then people can go and select it as the answer. And then you could potentially use that to like feed that into documentation. So, you know, I think we've got to kind of...
Forums in general do that, but that's useful, yes.
Yeah.
Being able to layer that kind of... that you can have that kind of structured thing, as you say, where you can have submission and approval. You can have, you know, anointing particular threads or particular posts as being important or things that show up when you search for this or whatever.
Right. Yep. Well, we'll see what happens. Very interesting. I'm curious to see what's going to happen with Ghost. I would love to get Jono, what's his name, on the show at some point.
John O'Nolan. I think
he made a couple of good points, too, and it's not that Slack is necessarily bad. If you have a very small community that you want to build, it probably actually is a better avenue than a forum, just because a forum with 10 people tends to look emptier than a Slack with 10 people. And his point is they might have never got to the problem they had with an 11,000 person Slack had they not started with Slack, which is, I don't know that I agree, but it's an interesting philosophical question, I suppose.
That's actually an interesting wrinkle. Yeah, no, I hadn't considered it that way, but yeah, where you hit the tipping point of Slack because you've got a way that people can easily join and get involved and become part of the community. Whereas going to a forum and signing up and posting is quite nerve-wracking at times, especially if there's already a community there of people who know one another.
Right. And can I just end with the realization that I just had of how much they are dissuading you for trying to use it like this? Look at how hard it is to sign up for a new Slack. They don't have any register yourself functionality. Those are all third-party bots. The fact that you can't just join a Slack community should be very clear messaging from them that they don't want large, external, open communities to use Slack.
Yeah.
They could not build it into the tooling any more than that.
Yeah, I kind of get where you're coming from. I mean, I think they're becoming more focused on that, for sure. I think they're really trying to reduce this notion that, oh, well, I set up Slack for my community and it's crap. And it's a good job that they're doing that. So, we have a show.
We do. Now, I think I wanted to say, following up on, in the last show, we had a discussion about Chromebooks. And I've had quite a bit of feedback, and it's been very useful, so thank you very much, the community, for coming back to me with ideas. There's one thing I did want to point out. A whole bunch of people have gone, here is the solution, use Gallium OS, right, which seems to be some kind of repackaging of something akin to Debian or something for Chromebooks, which is all very nice and everything, but they don't do ARM Chromebooks, and the Chromebook we've got is an ARM one. So Gallium seems lovely, but doesn't work for ARM, so stop recommending Gallium. But I appreciate the fact that lots of people have come back to me. Even if they came back with that suggestion, they still listened and had an idea and fed back, and that's been really helpful. So I just want to say thank you for that.
Yeah. Did you ultimately find a solution to the problem? You figure something out?
What he's doing at the moment is, it seems that, having dug into his problem in a bit more detail,
he's going to buy a new laptop.
No. He's going to buy a new laptop a year from now, where he's got the money to buy a good one. That's the whole point.
Is he going to get a better job?
What he's looking at doing is, there are actually quite a few Chrome OS kind of packages, which, you know, proper Linux system will let you install whatever you want for packages and so on. And people built that Brew thing for Macs, which is kind of like that.
Yeah, Homebrew.
Yeah, Homebrewing, sort of imitation of dpackage. Well, there's a thing like that kind of for Chrome OS, where you can download a bunch of stuff. And it's primarily for sort of terminal tools and so on. But he's using it as a developer workstation. And things like Node and so on are in it. So, the thing is called Termux, I think. And it's basically, your initial thought is, but it's just a terminal app, who cares? But actually, it's a terminal app which is tied into this kind of repository of stuff. And that seems like quite a good way of turning an old Chromebook into an essentially terminal-driven developer machine. But if you're doing a lot of that kind of development, a lot of what you do is in the terminal anyway. So it's not a big problem. Yeah. And and then because you're not using Crouton, so you haven't got this completely separate world where you've got a separate Linux box running in essentially a VM, it's all, you know, kind of natively in quotes on Chrome OS. So that's quite cool. Because the whole thing about Crostini, which is the run proper Linux apps on your Chromebook, again, only works for pretty recent, relatively high-end, and not ARM Chromebooks. That suggestion went along with Gallium. But this Termux thing actually seems like quite a good idea. So that's what he's trying out.
Nice.
Yeah. So always nice to get the feedback that we ask for. Thank you for that.
Let us know how that works out.
On a related note, did you see that System 76 are starting to build out their factory?
Their manufacturing plant, yes, which is pretty cool.
Which, very cool.
It is.
We're big fans of System 76, so it's good to see that they're heading in that direction.
Yeah, and we had a really interesting chat with Carl at where was it? Scale, it was. We were
describing
a lot of this kind of thing. And this really does put the power in their hands to do things. There's been a whole bunch of them, but they're just a Clevo reseller. Like every other laptop manufacturer isn't just a Quanta reseller or a Clevo reseller or whatever. But now they can genuinely build their own things, top to bottom.
Yeah.
Which would be very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, very cool.
It might be worth, now that they're kind of getting into that, to have them on the show one of these days.
Yeah, and maybe we can get some free laptops out of them.
Go with our essential phones.
Exactly. Yeah, we might as well do that. You know, feel the love. So, good stuff. Anything else you guys want to share? Any talks coming up?
Not in the next 2 weeks. Anyway, I did enter a game jam, which is pretty cool.
A game jam?
Yeah.
Is that a game where you get jam at the end of it?
Yes, that's what it is. These are huge worldwide things. Aren't you supposed to call it jelly now anyway, you fucking yank? This is people put together, people say, here is a week or 2 weeks or 2 days or a weekend or whatever, and here's a theme, and you write a game. And then enter it, and then everyone votes on who won or whatever. And they're actually quite popular. A lot of them, you know itch.io? They're kind of essentially an indie version of Steam. Right.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And they've made quite a big play for game jam stuff, so it's really easy to set one up and administer it and so on itch. And so there's loads of game jams going on there all the time. And a couple of years ago, they did one called the Low Res Jam, where the rules are you can just write a game and enter it, but the screen is 64 pixels by 64 pixels, which is really tiny.
That is low res.
Yes, it is.
That's not low res. That's low
res. It is the lowest. Like, this is lower than
of the res.
This is lower than a Game Boy, right? A Sinclair Spectrum had a bigger resolution than this. It's nuts. So I entered a couple of years ago, and it was really good fun. And they did it last year, and I didn't enter. But this year, I did again. And it's going on at the moment. Now, I would shamelessly whine for votes, but you can only vote if you actually enter the competition. So I'm not going to. Otherwise, I would have done already, believe me. But it's just really interesting to spend a little bit of time building something kind of out of my comfort zone, right? I'm not a game dev. But
what kind of game have you made?
It's a puzzle game. You remember Pipe Mania, where you had to connect the pipes from beginning to end? And you know the game where you've got black and white squares, and when you click on a square, it flips it over, but it also flips the squares touching it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a combination of those two. So you get a Pipe Mania screen, but a load of the squares are rotated, and you've got to rotate them back into place. But clicking on a square rotates it and the ones touching it.
You're a bit of a... You've got some proven game experience, so you know what you're doing, right?
Well, it's... This is...
You did Riddling.
You know, not what I do. But I did Riddling, yeah. Again, you know, kind of a puzzle game doesn't have to be good at graphics. One of the advantages with a thing being 64 by 64 is I don't have to do super realistic skin textures, right? The game I produce does not have to look like Battlefield or whatever.
Right.
Not a problem. The latest Assassin's Creed, it ain't. So...
Right.
But yeah, it was just good fun, you know? It gave me a chance to just spend... Honestly, a few evenings, right? I'm not burning a load of time on this. I've got stuff to do. But it's good fun to do that and then see, and people vote on it and leave reviews, and I've been leaving reviews on their games and stuff like that. Just, like, nice little extra activity.
A good friend of mine who works at GitHub, Lee Riley, does a bunch of that kind of stuff for GitHub. He runs game jams there.
Oh, cool.
And, Lee's awesome. He's deeply, deeply passionate about video games. So. But
I was massively disappointed when the itch people put out a desktop app, like the Steam desktop app, right? And I tweeted at them and said that the slogan should be "Get itch or die trying," and they didn't do it, and I was really sad. Right, that's enough bad voltage.
Let's wrap it up. Yes, see you in a few weeks, people. Hang on. Eric is printing something. Keep recording. I knew this was going to be a problem.
Well,
what do you guys have, like a dot matrix printer?
I was going to say, have you got a dot matrix printer?
No, it's a laser printer, you cheeky
bastard. Well, how much noise does it make then?
Can you hear it?
No.
Ah, well, I'm just, you know, this is the commitment to audio quality that you two seem to neglect all of the time.
Well.
I, on the other hand, do not.
Given I just bought a whole bunch of new stuff just because of you bollocking me, I don't know that that's a
I was going to say, yeah, man has a point here. Right. When you start right. filling proper links into the fucking show notes, I'll start giving you shit about your opinion. As opposed to, I go there on Thursday morning and I go, right, okay, I need to write the show notes. And it just says, like, Google thing. And I think, well, what the fuck was that? Then I have to go back and listen to it and find the links myself.
All right, here we go.